Support for legislative coverage comes from USU's Department of Political Science, committed to improving the community, the state, the nation, and beyond, and supporting UPR's coverage of the Utah legislature. Information is at politicalscience.usu.edu.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Thanks for joining me on this Wednesday. Healthcare is simply too large and complex to manage at the federal level. How can we expect Washington bureaucrats to solve a problem they've helped create over the past several decades? That's a quote from the Healthcare Compact site, healthcarecompact.org. That's a collection of several states. Legislatures in some states have already passed this. It'd be an interstate compact, which would petition Congress for an exemption from all federal health reforms included in the Affordable Care Act, and instead ask Congress for a block grant to manage all health-related programs at the state level. And Senator Stuart Adams has sponsored a bill, Senate Bill 208, which would join Utah with these other states in that compact. Proponents say that states can manage health care more efficiently. There would be cost savings, and it would get us out from under the onerous provisions of the Affordable Care Act. Opponents say that it would increase costs. Some opponents say it would increase costs dramatically, resulting in people being kicked off programs or services reduced. And we're going to talk with proponents of this bill in the second part of the program. We'll have with us a half an hour from now Stan Rasmussen with the Sutherland Institute and Don Ruzicka from the Eagle Forum. Right now we're joined by Danny Harris, who is AARP Utah Advocacy Director. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined in this part of the program by Jason Cook, who is a Medicaid Research and Policy Director with Utah Health Policy Project. Jason Cook, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let me start with Danny Harris. From the point of view of AARP, I know that your group is opposed. Why are you opposed to Senate Bill 208?
Well, there's a number of reasons that we're opposed. I think that, you know, largely one of the biggest problems that we are concerned with is that our state now wants to take on Medicare, which is a program that our state has never dealt with in the past. They don't aren't quite as familiar as the federal government is in terms of what the needs are for the program, who is on the program, how much it would cost to administer. None of these questions are being asked or answered in this entire discussion. You know, as we look at some of the issues with the cost related to this program, our state hasn't looked at the fact that these programs grow based on health care or medical inflation rates, while the funding for this program would grow at a much slower rate, which means there would be less funding for these programs, and we'd have to look at either cutting benefits to people, reducing reimbursement rates to providers, or something along those lines. One of the other options would then be to take from other state programs in order to fund this large program.
Let's bring in Jason Cook. What is your group's reasons for opposing this bill?
Well, we share AARP's concerns about the Medicare aspects of this proposal. But beyond that, we find it ironic that the supporters of this bill are proposing something that's going to grow Utah state government. And a lot of people will look at organizations like ours and say, well, you guys are big government organizations. The reality is we want as lean an administration in Utah as we can get because we'd rather the money went to serving people. That's our priority. And frankly, under this bill, if we take over Medicare, as Danny was describing, we're going to have to hire a whole lot more people and buy a whole lot more support for those people, like computers and so forth, to administer the Medicare program. And beyond that, the legislature is going to have to hire more people because you know who gets all the complaints and letters from Medicare recipients now? Members of Congress, and they have staff dedicated to answering those kinds of inquiries. So all of those jobs are going to have to move down here to the Utah State Capitol, and we really don't think that's what people want to do.
I wonder if you could clarify for us the difference between Medicaid and Medicare. Right now, states administer Medicaid, is that right? But you say this would be a change with Medicare.
That's correct.
And who's on Medicaid versus who's on Medicare?
Well, Medicaid, it's principally families, pregnant women, children, people with disabilities, and people who are elderly. And Medicare, I'll let Danny speak to Medicare since he's the Medicare man.
Medicare is generally folks who are age 65 years and older, you know, seniors who have paid into this program over over an entire lifetime of work. We've all paid our payroll taxes as we work, and those are people who have worked, paid into those benefits to make sure that they have health security in retirement.
Now, under this the compact, that money would go from the feds to the states, would it not? So where does the problem come in? The money would just go to a different state entity, and under the proponent's view, states can manage this better.
Well, this is first of all, money that the state already receives. So there's no new money in the mix, and as Danny said, there's actually less money than we get now under the formula in the bill. What's going to be different is that the state is going to be asked to manage Medicare, something we've never managed before, something for which we're going to have to hire people to do the management. And again, from our perspective, if we're doing that at the cost of losing money and therefore having to cut services or even kick people off the programs, we just question whether that's the right trade-off. We understand the frustration with Washington, not only here at the legislature, but around the state. And frankly, as a former Medicaid administrator myself in Texas, I was pretty frustrated almost every day dealing with the feds because they were telling me what to do and what I couldn't do, and we were trying to do things that were going to bring better services to people. So I get that from my own personal experience. But the question is, do we solve that problem by basically slapping ourselves in the face and giving up federal money, which could otherwise go to improving the healthcare system in Utah, which is already top-notch, but we can always be better. And to be better, we've got to at least maintain the current level of federal funding.
Maybe to add to that as well, you know, the bill requests about $4.1 billion to administer all of these programs, $4.1 billion from the federal government. And many of the proponents of this bill have said this is $4.1 billion of new money that will be coming into the state. And like Jason said, that's not necessarily the case. Currently, Medicare provides $2.3 billion worth of services in our state. The federal government also pays about $1.4 billion for the Medicaid program. So just combining those two together, you've got the $3.7 billion there. You've only got $400 million to administer CHIP and some of the other programs that the state receives benefit from. That may include CDC funding, a lot of other things. We're not quite sure how that works. But we also have to look at the fact that our state thinks that the savings from this can come from cutting down on the administration. I recently looked at a Heritage Foundation report that stated that Medicare administration was about 6.4%, which, you know, roughly it means that for the $2.3 billion we get, that's $150 million in administration. There's just simply, because of the inflation of this program, there's simply not going to be enough savings in administration to cover the cost, the inflationary cost that we're looking at here.
Jason Cook, you said you understand the frustration with the bureaucracy at the federal level, but this is not the solution, you say. I wonder if you could expand on that, given that sense of frustration, and that's part of the impetus for this bill.
Well, I think we have to go back to the beginning on this. The proponents of this bill are strong advocates of innovation in healthcare, and we're right there with them. We think that that's where the progress lies. That's where we can make healthcare in Utah better through innovation. But the difference between us and the proponents is we think innovation without careful analysis and study and understanding of what the various consequences are of that innovation is irresponsible innovation. We're inviting problems by not carefully looking at what this legislation is going to mean in terms of lost federal funds, potential need to cut back on people's benefits, ask them to pay more for their benefits, cut back on what we pay their doctors to the point where their doctors say to their patients, I'm sorry, I'd like to keep seeing you, but I just can't afford it anymore. So from our perspective, the way to go about this kind of innovation is to really stop and understand what the consequences of this legislation would be. And if we want to get out of, for example, the Affordable Care Act, there are provisions for that. There's a way to do that without without slapping ourselves in the face and taking these kinds of cuts in our funding.
I want to ask about the numbers. To have you expand on numbers again, Danny Harris. The proponents say that there may even be cost savings from this. This seems to be one of the selling points, although not the main one. Seems to be a federal-state issue, seems to be the main driving force here. But you're saying, I believe you crunched the numbers and you talked about this a little bit before, I wonder if you could expand on this, that potentially Utah could lose millions upon millions of dollars if we went with this.
Well, you're exactly right. You know, I think the major purpose of this bill is a state's rights message here, and they're interested in running these programs because they feel that they can do a better job than the federal government, and that's a whole other issue. But when we do look at how the bill is structured, we do have to look at the inflationary effects of this. The Kaiser Foundation estimates that healthcare and medical inflation since the 1970s has been about 2.4% above regular GDP inflation, and so the funding for this compact grows at standard GDP inflation rates, where the Medicare and Medicaid programs typically inflate more closely to overall healthcare and medical inflation. So when you look at those inflationary effects just for Medicare alone, where you've got a $2.3 billion programs, in year one, a 2.4% increase in cost would create a shortfall of about $55 million just for Medicare. 10 years from now, we've estimated that for Medicare, there could be upwards of $500 million shortfall for that program alone. And when you're looking at a program that whose administration runs somewhere around $150 million for our state, you can't find that kind of savings in administration to cover that kind of a shortfall. And you've got to start looking elsewhere to see where you can find savings. And unfortunately, what ends up happening there is, like Jason said, you either cut reimbursement rates to providers where doctors say, I can't accept Medicare patients anymore, or benefits begin to be cut to seniors, or another option is saying, well, we're just going to have to shift more of these costs to seniors. We're going to have to increase their premiums or their co-pays or things like that in order to defer some of the cost to someone else.
I think this, if I can add, I think this savings issue is really gets at the crux of our concern about this bill. We have, as you have heard, we have costed out the potential downsides, money that we'll lose for Medicare, folks on Medicaid and on CHIP and who benefit from these other programs. The proponents of the bill say, well, we could save money, but they can't tell us how. They haven't been able to give us any numbers to give us a sense that, okay, we'll save enough money to make up for those federal dollars losses. And that, I think, illustrates the problem that we're basically asking the state with this bill to jump out of an airplane without checking whether the parachute's going to work. I don't think any of us would buy a house without going through the process of having inspected, understanding the neighborhood, see where our kids or grandkids are going to go to school and those kinds of things. And here we're buying a house basically sight unseen, and we'll figure out later whether we like the neighborhood. That just seems to us to be backward.
Are there circumstances where, if this were tested, where you could support this?
I think if the legislature decided that this was something that is worth careful study, bring people around the table who have some expertise in these areas and can offer some information that will help the legislature better understand what the pluses and minuses are, then I think it's appropriate to make a decision. this is not something that can really be tested, but it is something that we can understand better. And that's really what we ought to be doing when we're talking about something that potentially affects, it's potentially a life and death issue, because that's what healthcare is. It means, in some cases, the difference between life and death means the difference between life on a ventilator, or perhaps leading a more normal life, not having to be dependent on a ventilator to breathe. That's what healthcare is about. These compacts generally have been about things like transportation and commerce and so forth. And as important as those issues are, they're not life and death in the way that healthcare is. So we think that some extra care needs to be taken in this case.
Denny Harris, same question. AARP Utah, are there circumstances where your group could support this?
Well, you know, AARP is obviously very concerned about the future of the Medicare program. We know that there's over 280,000 lives in our state who depend on this program, and like Jason says, it's really a life or death situation for them. And we understand too that there's changes that need to be made federally in order to strengthen the programs. I think that our view, however, would be that these programs are too important to just make quick knee-jerk decisions in terms of let's do this in order to save this program. These programs, we ought to be having a national conversation about what needs to be done with Medicare in order to strengthen it for future generations. This is it's not something that can just be done quickly in a 45-day legislative session where there hasn't been that public involvement in the future of the program.
If you just joined us, we're talking about a healthcare compact. This is a national movement. The proponents hope it'll be a national movement. Several state legislatures have signed on. The legislature passed it and the governor vetoed it. But what the healthcare compact proponents hope is that many states will join this, petition Congress for an exemption from all federal health reforms included in the Affordable Care Act, and ask Congress instead for a block grant to give the money instead to the states, and they can manage those programs at the state level. In this part of the program, we're talking with Jason Cook, who's Medicaid Research and Policy Director for Utah Health Policy Project, and with Danny Harris, with AARP Utah, Advocacy Director there. In the second half, we'll hear from proponents of Senate Bill 208. It's sponsored by Senator Stuart Adams. That'll be Stan Rasmussen with Sutherland Institute and Don Ruzicka from the Eagle Forum. And you're welcome to join this conversation on health care at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com, or you can call us. Love to have your call at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. Another 5 minutes left with opponents of Senate Bill 208, and then we'll have proponents coming in the next half of the program. I want to ask each of you just a general question about the Affordable Care Act, maybe starting with Danny Harris, AARP Utah, on this. I don't know if your group supported or opposed that. That'd be the first question.
Yes, we supported the Affordable Care Act.
And why? What are the main provisions, why you think it's a step forward?
Well, one of the major problems that we have in our country right now is just an uninsured problem. There's so many hundreds of thousands of people in our country who are currently uninsured, who aren't getting access to the health care that they need. The Affordable Care Act goes a long way in terms of just solving that problem, in terms of getting people insured and giving them a route where they can get the care that they need. In addition, it strengthens programs like Medicare by encouraging preventative care rather than having people show up at an emergency room for unnecessary care for the ER. That's why we're supportive of it. It's a fundamental change in terms of starting to get people access to the health care that they need.
Let me ask the same question of you, Jason Cook, Utah Health Policy Project. The group supports the Affordable Care Act.
We did support the ACA when it was being considered by Congress, and for much the same reasons that Danny expressed, although I think it's important to remember about the issue of the uninsured. It is an issue for all of us who are fortunate enough to have insurance through our jobs or by buying it ourselves in the private market. And the reason for that is every time somebody who's uninsured goes to, let's say, the emergency room, and the hospital can't get paid for that, that adds to their costs, which means when they go to negotiate the rates they get paid by insurers for the rest of us, they're going to negotiate a higher payment to offset that loss. Well, when the insurance company in turn has to pay the hospital more, where do you think they're going to turn to make that up? To you and me. They're going to add to our premiums in order to subsidize that care for the uninsured. So it's much more efficient in terms of how the healthcare system operates to go ahead and find ways to get those uninsured folks into some kind of coverage so we don't have that kind of ongoing dynamic of rising private premiums. The increase in private premiums that are due to the uninsured are around $1,000 a year. So anybody who's insured in Utah could be saving $1,000 a year if we would just get more people into the insurance system, get them coverage, and as Danny said, get them into seeing a doctor instead of taking their problems to the emergency room all the time.
I want to just expand on it. We just have a couple of minutes left and start with Jason Cook on this sort of final thoughts. What would you like to see done? You're opposing Senate Bill 208. What are some steps you would hope would happen at the legislature that could it improve health care in Utah?
Well, I think that from our perspective, the most important thing right now is to make sure that the programs we are operating, where we are doing it better, like the Medicaid program in Utah, make sure those programs are funded so they can do the job we've asked them to do. You know, the Department of Health probably spends about 2%, 2-3% of the Medicaid budget on administration. I would challenge anybody to point to that lean and administrative structure in a private insurance product anywhere in the country. That is leading edge. And for it to continue to be leading edge, we need to make sure that the agency has the tools that they need to manage this program. We need to make sure that people who are eligible can get into the program so they can get the care they need before they get sick, so we manage those costs better. And I think the other thing that we're really focused on is the state made a decision in the last legislative session to reform the Medicaid program and bring it into accountable care. And what accountable care means is we're going to pay doctors and hospitals and other providers not just based on each service that they provide. We're going to pay them based on making and keeping people well. So we're going to tie the dollars to the results that we all want from our healthcare system, whether it's public or private. That is a huge revolution in the way we run public programs. And if the legislature can keep us on that track and not be distracted by things like the healthcare compact, that's going to be the best deal for the people of Utah.
And we'll give Danny Harris from AARP Utah the last word in this half hour. What needs to be done to improve healthcare in Utah?
Well, you know, Utah has been doing a great job at looking at our health system here and overall and what needs to be done to reform it. Long before the Affordable Care Act came along, Utah was looking at their own health system reform, implemented the Utah Health Insurance Exchange, and they've been working on that to give people access to health insurance and to health care that they need. Like Jason mentioned, that recently we've had a total transformation of our Medicaid program, moving to more accountable care. And so the state has been looking at this for years in terms of what Utah's health system needs, coming up with Utah solutions that best solve our unique problems. And the last thing that we want to do is join a compact of states that, you know, the other states who have passed this compact are lower performing states. We don't want to tie ourselves to them when Utah's already started down this path of our own health system reform. We ought to continue down that form, and those steps are being taken now.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Very interesting. Thank you to both of you for joining us in this half hour. Danny Harris, AARP Utah Advocacy Director, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Jason Cook, who's Medicaid Research and Policy Director with Utah Health Policy Project. Thank you.
Thank you. the opportunity.
And those groups oppose Senate Bill 208, which would join Utah with the Health Care Compact. We'll continue this discussion with proponents of Senate Bill 208 in the next half following a break. That'll be Stan Rasmussen from Sutherland Institute and Don Ruzicka from the Eagle Forum. Hope you'll join us then following this brief break.
Utah commentator Gina Wickwar.
I've been away from this microphone for a while now because of some major surgery that left me unable to sit for very long periods, and a radio essay requires several hours at the computer. The surgery went well, though there was a minor complication that prolonged my hospital stay, but by and large, I am coming along swimmingly. As any of you know who have spent more than 3 days in a hospital, it is a dreadful experience. Oh, the nurses, doctors, and interns are all well-intended, kind, thoughtful, and wanting to help you get better. But whatever way you slice it, it is still a hospital, with needles and pokes, buzzers, dinging machines, the constant whirring of electronics, numerous tests, and strange people appearing in the middle of the night to take your vitals. So I felt a great sense of relief when I was let out of captivity on Christmas Eve, just in time to be home for Christmas. There can't be a better place in this country than Cache Valley if you've just come home from 12 days in the hospital, are taking pain pills, are not feeling totally up to par, and can't do a lot of standing and walking, all of which boils down to the basic fact that I was not able to cook. And once people found that out, which was immediately, I didn't have to turn on my stove for weeks. Friends, neighbors, folks in the ward we barely knew, everyone called or dropped by to wish me well. But mostly they brought us food, casseroles, soups, baked good, jelly, juices, snacks, and any other thing edible. We were awash in delicious homemade cakes, meatloaf, stew, mac and cheese, and hams, and of course, flowers. At one point, my living room looked like a floral shop. If I were deeply grateful for this kind and thoughtful generosity, my husband was perhaps even more so, especially since he has rarely turned on an oven in all the years of our marriage. He now realized he wouldn't have to nuke a TV dinner every night, after all, which pleased him no end. Naturally, there is no way we can repay all our kind friends and neighbors, and they know that and expect nothing. It was just in their hearts to do a kindness, to make things in life a little easier for someone who couldn't manage for a while. I hadn't put up a Christmas tree or decorations before I went into the hospital in mid-December, knowing I would be in no position when I came home to take them all down. But I can tell you from the bottom of my heart, even without a tree, or my nutcrackers, or my banister boughs, or all the bows and ribbons, I haven't had a nicer Christmas in many, many years. All that was done for me by friends and a few people I hardly knew reinforced what I've always really known, that Christmas is about love, friendship, and caring, more than it's about a tree, some presents, and a wreath or two. This is Gina Wickwar.
Support for coverage of the Utah Legislature comes from the USU Charter Credit Union, serving members with 24 local ATMs and more than 28,000 ATM access points across Utah and the U.S. through the Credit Union Co-op Network. Information is at usuccu.org.
Thanks for joining us for the second half of Access Utah. We're talking about health care in Utah. What should be done about health care? Specifically, Senate Bill 208. This is sponsored by Senator Stuart Adams. It's passed out of committee. It's being considered by the full Senate now, which would join Utah with something called the Health Care Compact. This is a movement which is trying to get several states, I'm sure they would like all states, to join in petitioning Congress for an exemption from all federal health reforms included in the Affordable Care Act, and ask Congress instead for a block grant so that health care could be managed at the state level. Proponents say that states can manage health care better than can the federal government. There might even be cost savings, and in any case, that this is a federal overreach on the constitutional level. Opponents say that there are possible health care increases in costs, and that reforms at the Utah level should be allowed to work. We talked with opponents of this bill in the last part of the program. Hope you joined us then. Jason Cook from Utah Health Policy Project and Danny Harris from AARP Utah. Now, we're joined by Don Ruzicka, Executive Director of Utah Eagle Forum. Mr. Ruzicka, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Glad for the opportunity.
And we're also joined by Stan Rasmussen with the Sutherland Institute. Mr. Rasmussen, I can't read my own writing. What's your title there?
I'm the Director of Public Affairs for Sutherland Institute.
Okay. I will write it down in a better fashion here. Thank you. And thanks for joining us.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Let me start with you, Stan Rasmussen. Your understanding of what the healthcare compact is and why you should, Utah should join it.
Thank you. Well, the healthcare compact proposal is a proposal that Utah become a member of the healthcare compact. And of course, compacts are very common. A compact is an understanding among states. It could be as few as two or as many as 50. But this healthcare compact is an opportunity for the state to join with other states and petition Congress for a change in the status quo, a change which would bring the decision authority and the funds back to the state of Utah to be utilized according to the discretion and intent of the leaders of the state of Utah, as opposed to the current situation where they're being expended according to policy and regulation and administration through a central nationalized federal government process.
Don Ruzicka, as I understand it, this is viewed as a constitutional problem. Is that not correct, that the federal government is overreaching?
Well, I would agree with that completely, and that's why we would enthusiastically support the concept of this compact. In reading the proposed legislation, there's not a lot of specifics in it, which I think is essential at this point, because that would be one of the purposes of the compact, would be to determine, you know, all of the specific provisions and what each state would and would not want to participate in terms of taking over what the federal government is now doing. But it's an issue, as has been mentioned by the previous participants in your program here, that has to do with states' rights. We believe that the federal government has far overreached its constitutional authority, not just in health care, but in many areas. So I view this as a critical first step in beginning to rebalance the affiliation between states and the federal government. We really don't know at this point what the final outcome would be, and that was one of the arguments that your previous participants had. But the reality is that the federal government has the same problems that they were talking about that we would have as a state.
Let me ask you a general question. I asked this near the end of the last half hour. I asked this of each of my guests near the beginning this time around. The Affordable Care Act, I'm guessing that Utah Eagle Forum posed that. What are the problems you have with the ACA?
I don't think there's enough time on the program for me to air all of my opposition to the Affordable Care Act. It's first of all, again, it's constitutionally not just flawed, but it's not allowed under the Constitution. Secondly, the problems that we face in healthcare, and I've got a 38-year background in the health insurance field, so I deal with employers and individuals on a daily basis and have, a pretty good understanding of what the problems are and what situations are being caused by government intervention into our healthcare system. But the Affordable Care Act is simply another step, possibly the final step, in an agenda that I believe has been going on for decades to transform our healthcare system from a free market system into a ultimately a nationalized healthcare system. It's just unacceptable. The problems that have been created in the healthcare system by federal intervention are just legion. And like I say, I don't believe there's time to go in and deal with those issues individually, but the biggest problem we have is the intervention of government, both on a federal and a state level in many cases. And so I think that the benefit of the compact is that we get tighter control over government intervention into the healthcare system. I'm not saying that the compact is the final solution, because on a state level we have the same potential problems we do on a federal level, but at least on a state level we have a greater degree of control. On the federal level we have essentially none. So that's where we are coming from on this.
Let me ask the same question of Stan Rasmussen. I'm guessing Sutherland Institute opposed ACA. If so, why?
Well, let me just say the healthcare compact does not conflict with efforts by state attorney generals and state legislators, members of Congress, to repeal or modify what we consider the overreaching national health care bill known euphemistically as the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. And I think for not to overwork this point, but it's important to understand the context where this is coming out of. The compact really gives Utah the opportunity to start working in collaboration with other states toward a restoration of state sovereignty, overcoming the now dysfunctional and codependent relationship between the states and the national government, and in so doing, reestablishing a healthy, mutually respectful, and functional relationship between states and the national government that the states created with the completion of the Constitution in 1787, subsequent ratification, and then in 1791, the ratifying of the first 10 amendments that we know as the Bill of Rights. And notable there is the 10th Amendment that unequivocally declares that powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution are prohibited by it to the states or reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And so the transfer of health care policy authority and funds back to the states that are at the core of the purpose of the health care compact would require congressional approval. And for this reason, at present, we recognize that there's little chance that such a power shift on health care policy would be authorized, at least now. Democrats are in control in the Senate in Washington, while Republicans lead the House. The states that have joined and those now considering joining the health care compact are looking forward to a political climate and preparing for a Congress willing to step back from the brink and acknowledge that health care policy is the legitimate province of the states.
So is this, given that the current political reality, is this essentially a message bill?
No, this is far from a message bill. This is a specific, effective effort to identify states who want to step up, join the Compact Commission. In fact, it would be useful to point out that the passage of SB 208, the Healthcare Compact Bill, now before the Senate in Utah, would adopt the Healthcare Compact, define some terms, and would have Utah join an interstate advisory healthcare commission. And the state effectively would be pledging to collaborate with other states in the compact to secure consent of the Congress to the compact, so that the return of authority and the regulatory responsibility goes back to the states.
Let me ask, turn to Don Brzezicka. I want to have you answer some of the objections from opponents of this bill. And we heard in the first half of the program that seems to be the main reason for opposing from the groups that we talked to was potential cost. And one estimate that was used by our guest then, one of those, $500 million loss just from Medicare alone if this were enacted. I wonder if you see those big of losses or what would happen if this compact were enacted and actually put into effect?
Well, I wrote down some of the objections from your previous guests, and, you know, these cost estimates are just that, they're estimates, and they're based, I think, as much on political perspective as they are on reality. The reality is that we really don't know until we find out just what parts of the federal management of health care would be taken over by the state, and then some more specific studies could be done. But the other reality is that talk about these cost estimates or losses is really academic at this point because nobody really knows. What we do know is that the federal government is in deep trouble in trying to manage these massive programs, and all of the objections or the fears that were expressed by your previous guests are in fact going to come to pass under the federal management. Medicare is in deep trouble, and I know this for a number of reasons. One, I'm involved in the industry that provides insurance coverages to seniors. I myself am a senior participating in those coverages, and I see the impacts that have already taken place on cost based on the Affordable Care Act. And we haven't even begun to see the major cost contributors that are going to come from further implementation of the provisions of the ACA. So I don't think that it's productive at this point to talk fear, basically, of the states taking over this management when the federal government is already looking at very difficult decisions that are going to have to be made in order to prolong these programs. I don't think there's any question in anybody's mind that the Medicare program is going to result in reduced provider payments and or reduced benefits. It simply is no longer sustainable in its current form. So whether it's federally managed or state managed, they're going to have to look at ways to cut costs. What that final cost-cutting mechanism is going to be, I don't know. But I have more confidence in the states being able to manage that cost and being able to be controlled by constituencies and the people who are affected by those costs than I am the federal government.
Stan Rasmussen, your view on the same question of cost.
No, I concur completely with what Donna said. I think it's important to point out that one of the primary benefits of joining the compact is that Utah will be able to run its Medicaid program free of wasteful, one-size-fits-all federal mandates and without the brokerage fee that Washington exacts before sending Medicaid funds to the state. In other words, SB 208 under this bill, with Utah joining the compact, it will mean that the state can spend less on mandates from federal bureaucrats who have little or no knowledge of what's best for Utahns and will have more funds to spend on actually improving the health of those on Medicaid. I would point out that the scope of the compact, as I've mentioned, as we've talked about, not only would restore decision authority and implementation authority to the state, it would also bring all the funds that are currently being expended through the federal processes for Medicaid, Medicare, and CHIP. It would not include healthcare funds that are administered through programs that serve the active military or Veterans Affairs or Indian Affairs.
Mm.
So that's a sizable amount. Yes. It's a large amount of money that would come here and be exercised under the discretion of Utah leaders and policymakers for the benefit of Utahns, and as Donna said, which is much better than dealing with the one-size-fits-all cookie-cutter method that we have right now.
As you probably heard in the first half, what ironic, at least the opponents of this bill spin it as ironic, this would grow Utah government, wouldn't it?
Oh, well, yeah, I wrote that one down. It's a little bit paradoxical to me that someone would be concerned about growing state government but have apparently little concern about the growth of federal government, which is far less manageable on a state level. I'm not sure that would, in fact, grow state government in the context that they presented it. It's simply bringing management functions back to the states where they belong, and should be in the first place. The reason that the federal system is not working is because the federal government has grown so dramatically over the years that it becomes almost unmanageable simply by its size. So breaking it up into 50 smaller components, I think, is a much better management technique.
Of course, one.
Let me just share this.
Yes, go ahead.
This thought, you know, for the folks who have said, and I did not hear your earlier guess, but I have seen information that they've published. I'd have to think that the statement was probably hard for the Health Policy Project people to write that with a straight face. And talking about irony, as it seems not to admit a government healthcare funding program it doesn't like. So let me paint a picture. UHPP versus Sullivan Institute or Eagle Forum or other groups, which groups are more likely to support or oppose increased government and spending? The reality is when that policy authority and those funds come to the state of Utah, there probably will be a need to increase the number of state government employees to administer that, and it's the right thing to do.
If you just joined us, we're talking about the Healthcare Compact. This is a proposed compact among states, which would then ask Congress for an exemption from all federal health reforms included in the Affordable Care Act, and ask Congress instead for a block grant so that states could manage health-related programs at the state level. And in the first part of the program, we did hear from Jason Cook from Utah Health Policy Project and Danny Harris from AARP Utah. Right now, we're talking with Don Ruzicka from the Eagle Forum, Utah Eagle Forum, and Stan Rasmussen of the Sutherland Institute. We'd love to have your comments or questions at 1-800-826-1495. That's the toll-free number, 1-800-826-1495. Or you can email us at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. We have another 5 or 6 minutes left with our guests in this half the program. I'd like to ask each of you a general question, as I asked my guests in the first half of the program. The problem is outlined very starkly, of course, by the proponents of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. There are many uninsured, and insurance is tied to jobs. Other countries, in proponents' view, have successfully untethered this from jobs, and you just have your insurance wherever you go. And we have inefficient emergency room care. Costs are higher that way. So maybe starting with Stan Rasmussen on this one, in your view, what should be done? What can best be done to improve healthcare service in the U.S.
Well,
and Utah?
We need to chunk it down and let individual states make those decisions for themselves. There are enough regional and state-based differences that would be a much more effective way to deal with the needs. If the question is, what about the lack of funds, as Don Ruzicka has pointed out, if there are lack of funds now, there are going to be challenges regarding the amount of funds later. And so the question really comes down to this. Who is better equipped and who do we trust to provide policy framework and to implement healthcare policy for people in the state of Utah, state leaders or national bureaucrats?
Don Ruzicka, are there specific programs that you've seen out there, maybe, you know, state experiments that have worked well that you would advocate?
No, in a word. My philosophy comes from the private sector, because I have experience that goes back to a time when the private sector handled the problems quite effectively. But let me just say that I believe this discussion boils down to a basic difference in fundamental philosophy, one of whether health care is actually a right or whether it's something that it's a benefit that we all have access to. This uninsured question, I don't understand why anybody could even point to that, because under every federal program historically that was supposed to address the uninsured problem has simply grown. HIPAA, for example, they were talking about 37 million uninsured back in the days of HIPAA, and the uninsured problem now, as it's stated federally, the uninsured are a greater number than that, and HIPAA didn't solve anything. In fact, it's created worse problems than it was intended to fix. So it's a basic difference in philosophy. I'm a firm proponent of the private sector and a free market, because a free market functions to correct these problems on its own. We have greater numbers of uninsured because the costs keep increasing. The federal government keeps blaming it on the private sector, the evil insurance industry and profiteering medical providers and all those kinds of things. The reality is that everybody in the current system has to play defense in order to survive, and that does nothing but contribute to the ever-growing costs that we all face. I remember a time not too long ago when private insurance companies offered guaranteed issue group health insurance to groups down to 2 employees. That means they didn't have to provide medical information. They were guaranteed to be able to get group health insurance coverage. That wasn't a government mandate. That was the private sector operating in a competitive marketplace. Nobody ever talks about those things anymore. It's all about why the private sector is failing. The private sector is failing because of government intervention. That's the plain and simple truth. Now, getting it back to the states through this compact gives us an opportunity to be closer to the people who are making the decisions about our health care system, and therefore having a better chance of allowing the free market to operate and to control costs and access on its own.
And we'll give the last word to Stan Rasmussen from Sutherland Institute. Maybe your projection. Do you think it's likely that Senate Bill 208 passes? And what would be the next step if it does?
Yes, I believe it will, and it will move to the House, where I think it will have a very careful scrutiny, and I believe it will pass. At this point, 4 states have passed. We have this process underway in about 10 or 11 other states right now. The intent is to get to that critical mass where we can then, as a group of states, negotiate with Congress. I guess the final word, as you put it, I would just say that we believe that supporting SB 208, the health care compact bill, really comes down to answering a basic question. Do we think that Utah is better able to address the health care needs of its citizens than federal bureaucrats in Washington, D.C.? If the answer to that is yes, then it makes sense to support the bill. There will be several decision points moving along, but that's the question right now.
We'll leave it there, out of time. Interesting discussion. In the first part of the program, we had opponents of the bill, Jason Cook from Utah Health Policy Project, Danny Harris from AARP Utah. And in this half hour, we were joined by Executive Director of Utah Eagle Forum, Don Ruzicka, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And Stan Rasmussen, Director of Public Affairs for Sutherland Institute. Thanks to you.
Tomorrow,
we talk about medieval art with a visiting professor, Yaroslav Fulda, and then we have a conversation, Lee Austin, with Cheryl Wudun, talking about women's rights around the world. That's the program tomorrow. Hope you'll join us then. Thanks for listening today to Access Utah.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.